considering, and Jamie waited patiently. Green was a man of fairly strong opinions, but he didn't give them hastily. Jamie did wonder what there was to consider in his question, though. Were Quakers even stranger in their customs than he thought?
Well,
Green said again, and exhaled, settling his shoulders.
I must tell you, General, that I no longer consider myself a friend, though I was indeed raised in that sect.
He shot Jamie a sharp look.
And I must also tell you that the cause of my departure was a mislike of their narrow-minded, superstitious ways. If your nephew means to turn Quaker, sir, I'd recommend you do your best to dissuade him.
Oh, well, that's part of the difficulty, I gather,
Jamie replied equably. He doesn't mean to turn Quaker himself, and I think that's a wise decision. He isn't suited for it at all. Green relaxed a little at that and went so far as to smile, if wryly.
Glad to hear it. But he has no objection to his wife remaining a friend. I think he's better sense than to suggest otherwise.
That made Green laugh.
Perhaps he'll manage marriage well enough, then. Or he'll make a bonny husband for the lass of Ni Dut. It's the getting them wed that seems a difficulty.
Ah, yes.
Green glanced round the homestead, wiping his wet face with a wadded handkerchief.
That might, in fact, be very difficult if the young woman, well, let me think for a moment. In the meantime, the well's good, but we can't store powder here. There's not much roof left, and I'm told this weather often presages thunderstorms.
There's likely a root cellar at the back, Jamie suggested.
There was. The door had gone, and a tangle of spindly, pallid vines had sprouted from a rotted sack of potatoes, abandoned in the corner, tendrils crawling in slow desperation toward the light.
It'll do,
Green decided, and made a penciled note in the small book he carried everywhere.
Let's move on, then.
They let the horses drink, poured more water over themselves, and rode on, gently steaming. Green wasn't a chatterer, and there had been no conversation for a mile or two when he finally reached a conclusion of his mental processes.
The principal thing to bear in mind regarding friends, he said, without preliminary, is that they depend very much upon one another's company and opinion, often to the exclusion of the world outside their meetings.
He shot Jamie a glance.
The young woman. Is your nephew known to her meeting?
Mm-hmm,
Jamie said.
As I understand from her brother, they were both put out of their meeting in a small place in Virginia when he decided to become a surgeon in the Continental Army. Or perhaps he was put out and she merely went with him. I don't know whether it makes a difference.
Oh, I see.
Green plucked the wet shirt away from his body in hopes of emitting a little air to his skin, but it was a vain hope. The air lay thick as a woolen blanket on the simmering countryside.
A fighting Quaker, as they call it.
No, he will not take up arms, Jamie assured Green.
But apparently his merely being connected with the army offended his meeting.
Green snorted in what appeared to be a personal way, and Jamie cleared his throat.
In fact, Denzel Hunter, Dr. Hunter, also is engaged to be married, though his path may be somewhat smoother in that his bride has become a friend herself. Has she a home meeting?
Green asked sharply. Jamie shook his head.
No, it appeared to be a private event. The conversion, I mean. I am told that Quakers dinna have either clergy or ritual.
He left that hanging delicately, and Green snorted again.
Nor do they. But I assure you, General, there is nothing truly private in a friend's life. Certainly no spiritual matter. My own father opposed reading as being a practice likely to separate one from God. And when, as a young man, I not only read, but began to collect works on military strategy, in which I had an interest, I was brought before an examination committee from our meeting and subjected to such questions as to... Well, as I say, I am no longer a member of that sect.
He blew out his lips, and made small rumbling noises for a bit, frowning at the road ahead. Though Jamie saw that, even in his preoccupation, Green was taking note of their surroundings with an eye to logistics. He himself had become aware of a certain vibration in the air, and wondered if Green sensed it. Not quite noise. It was a disturbance that he knew well. A large body of men and horses, too far away to see their dust, but there. They'd found the British Army. He slowed a little, looking carefully at the trees ahead in case of British scouts. For the British must surely know by now that they were pursued. Green's hearing was less acute, though, or perhaps he was only preoccupied, for he glanced at Jamie in surprise, though he slowed as well. Jamie raised a hand to stop him speaking, and lifted his chin. There was a rider coming toward them following the road. The sound of hooves was audible, and Jamie's own mount flung up his head and whickered with interest, nostrils flaring. Both men had come armed. Green set a hand on the musket balanced across his saddle. Jamie left his rifle in its sling, but checked the priming of the pistols in his saddle holsters. Awkward to fire a long gun from horseback. The rider was coming slowly, though. Jamie's hand on the pistol's grip relaxed, and he shook his head at Green. They reined up, waiting. And a moment later, the rider came in view.
"Ian! Uncle Jamie!"
Ian's face blossomed with relief at sight of him. And no wonder. He was dressed like a Mohawk, in buckskin leggings and calico shirt, with feathers in his hair, and a long, hairy, grey carcass lay across his saddle bow, blood dripping slowly from it down the horse's leg. The beast wasn't dead, though. Rollo twitched and raised his head, giving the newcomers a yellow wolf glare, but recognized Jamie's scent and barked once, then let his tongue loll out, panting.
"What's happened to the hound, then?"
Jamie rode up alongside and leaned forward to look.
"The numpty fell into a deadfall trap," Ian said, frowning rebuke at the dog. Then he gently scratched the big dog's ruff. "Mind, I'd have fallen in it myself if he hadn't have gone before me." "Bad hurt?" Jamie asked.
He didn't think so. Rollo was giving General Green his usual look of appraisal, a look that made most people take a few steps back. Ian shook his head, his hand curled into Rollo's fur to keep him steady.
"Nay, but he's torn his leg and he's lame. I was looking for a safe place to leave him. I've got to report in to Captain Mercer. Though, seeing as you're here..." "Oh, good day to you, sir," he said to Green,
whose horse had backed up in response to Rollo, and was presently indicating a strong desire to keep going in spite of his rider's inclination. Ian sketched a salute and turned back to Jamie.
"Seeing as you're here, Uncle Jamie, could you maybe fetch Rollo back to the lines with you and get Auntie Claire to tend his leg?"
"Oh, aye," Jamie said, resigned, and swung down from the saddle, groping for his soggy handkerchief.
"Let me bind his leg first. I dinna want blood all over my breeks, and the horse will na like it either."
Green cleared his throat.
"As you mentioned reporting, Mr. Murray," he asked, with a sideways glance at Jamie, who nodded, "perhaps you'd be so good as to give me, as well as Captain Mercer, the benefit of your report."
"Aye, sir," Ian said agreeably. "The army's divided into three bodies now, with a great long line of baggage wagons in between. So far as I could tell, I exchanged words with another scout who'd gone all the way up the column. They're headed toward a place called Freehold. The ground's no very good for attack, folded up like a used napkin, all cut up with ravines and bitty creeks. Though the other scout told me there's meadows beyond that might do for a fight, and you could lure them or drive them out there." Green asked sharp questions, some of which Ian could answer, and some he couldn't, while Jamie tended to the ginger business of binding up the dog's leg. There was a nasty stake wound, though not too deep. He hoped the stake hadn't been poisoned. Indians would do that sometimes, in case a wounded deer or wolverine might spring out of the trap. Jamie's horse was not enthused at the prospect of carrying a wolf on his back, but eventually was persuaded, and with no more than a nervous eye-roll backward now and then, they were mounted. "Furiachwing," Ian said, leaning over and scratching Rollo behind the ears. "I'll be back, aye?" "Thank, Uncle." And with a brief nod to Green, he was away, his own horse clearly wanting to put as much distance between himself and Rollo as possible.
"Dear Lord," Green said, wrinkling his nose at the dog's reek.
"Aye, well," Jamie said, resigned. "My wife says you get used to any sort of smell after a bit of smelling it, and I suppose she'd know." "Why, is she a cook?"
"Och no, a physician.
Gangrene, Ken, festering bowels and the like."
Green blinked.
"I see. You have a most interesting family, Mr. Fraser."
He coughed and looked after Ian, rapidly vanishing in the distance.
"You might be wrong about him never becoming a Quaker. At least he doesn't bow his head to a title."
Chapter 61. A viscous three-way. Jamie came back from his ride with General Green, looking damp, wrinkled, and completely dishevelled, but otherwise refreshed, and with Rollo, bloody and disgruntled, but not badly hurt.
"You'll be fine," I said, scratching Rollo gently behind the ears.
The gash had bled a lot, but wasn't deep. "I don't think I'll stitch it."
"Didn't blame you a bit, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, glancing at the dog, who had suffered my cleaning, salving and bandaging his leg, but didn't look at all inclined to stand for more fiddling.
"Where are my good stockings?"
"In the portmanteau with your other linen," I replied patiently, "where they are every morning. Surely you know that?"
"I do," he admitted. "I just like you to tend to me."
"All right," I said, obligingly pulling them out. "Do you want me to put them on for you?"
"Nay, I can manage that,"
he said, taking them.
"Could you find my shirt, though?"
"I think I can do that, yes," I replied, taking the shirt out of the same portmanteau and shaking it out. "How was General Green this morning?"
"Good." "I asked him about the Quaker way of marriage," he said, pulling a fresh white shirt, his only fresh white shirt, as I pointed out, over his head. "Evidently the difficulty is with Denzel and Rachel not having a home meeting, as it's called. It's no that they canna marry, but to do it in the proper way, it would involve the whole meeting. There's a thing called a clearness committee, which meets with the bride and groom to counsel them and make sure they're suited, and that they've some notion what they're in for."
He shrugged into the sleeves and grinned at me.
I couldn't help thinking, while he was telling me, what a committee like that would have had to say about us when we wed.
"Well, they wouldn't have had any more notion what we were in for than we did," I said, amused. "Do you think they would have thought us well suited?"
"If they'd seen the way I looked at you, Sassenach, when you didn't see me looking, then aye, they would."
He kissed me briefly and looked round for the hairbrush.
"Can you club my hair up for me? I can't be reviewing my troops like this."
His hair was tied back carelessly with a leather thong, damp stray wisps sticking to his face. "Of course. How many of them are you reviewing, and when?" I sat him down on the stool and set to work with the brush. "Have you been burrowing through the countryside head first? You have foxtails and leaves in your hair, and those winged seeds that elder trees make. Ooh, to say nothing of this." I carefully removed a tiny green caterpillar that had become entangled in his tresses and showed it to him, perched inquisitively on my forefinger.
"Halagia," he said to the caterpillar.
"Go with God." And taking it carefully on his own finger, he brought it to the tent flap and loosed it into the grass.
"All of them, Sassenach," he said, returning and sitting down again. "My last two companies came in this morning. They'll have been fed now and rested a bit. I meant to ask," he added, twisting round to look up at me, "would you come with me, Sassenach, and have a look at them, to see if any should be left back from the fighting, or to tend any that might need the odd bit of repair?"
"Yes, of course. When?"
"Come to the parade ground in an hour, if you would."
He passed a hand over the neatly gleaming auburn queue, doubled on itself, and ribboned in a club at his nape.
Aye, that's grand. Am I decent otherwise?
He stood up and brushed bits of discarded leaf from his sleeve. The crown of his head brushed the tent, and he was glowing with sun, energy, and the suppressed excitement of impending action.
"You look like Bloody Mars, God of War," I said dryly, handing him his waistcoat. "Try not to scare your men."
His mouth quirked as he shrugged into the waistcoat, but he spoke seriously, eyes on mine.
"Och, I want them frightened of me, Sassenach. It's the only way I'll have a chance of bringing them out of it alive."
With an hour to spare, I took my kit of everyday medical supplies and went out to the big tree where the sick among the camp followers tended to gather. The army surgeons would tend camp followers as well as soldiers if they had time. But they wouldn't be having time today. There was the usual assortment of minor ailments and injuries. A deeply embedded splinter, infected, requiring the application of drawing salve, followed by excavation, disinfection, and bandage. A dislocated toe, caused by the patient having kicked a fellow in play, but the work of a moment to reduce. A split lip, requiring one stitch and a little gentian ointment. A badly gashed foot, the result of inattention while chopping wood, requiring 28 stitches and a large dressing. One child with an ear infection, an onion poultice and willow bark tea prescribed. Another with the belly ache, peppermint tea, and a strong admonition against eating eggs of unknown age out of birds' nests of unknown provenance. The few patients requiring medicines I put aside until I'd dealt with the injuries. Then, with a wary eye on the sun, I led them off to my tent to dispense packets of willow bark, peppermint, and hemp leaves. The tent flap was open. Surely I'd left it closed. I ducked my head into the gloom of the tent and stopped abruptly. A tall figure stood before me, apparently in the act of rifling my medicine chest. "What the devil are you doing with that?" I asked sharply, and the figure jerked, startled. My eyes had now become accustomed to the diffuse light, and I saw that the thief, if that's what he was a Continental officer, a captain.
"I beg your pardon, madam," he said, giving me a perfunctory bow. "I had heard there was a supply of medicaments here.
There is, and they're mine." This seemed a trifle ungracious, though I certainly thought his own attitude rather brusque, and I softened the remark a little. "What is it that you need? I imagine I can spare a little."
"Yours?"
He glanced from the chest, very clearly an expensive professional bit of furniture, to me. And his brows rose.
"What are you doing with a thing like that?"
Several possible replies flitted through my head, but I'd recovered from the surprise of seeing him sufficiently as not to make any of them. I settled for a neutral. "May I ask who you are, sir?"
"Oh."
Mildly flustered, he bowed to me.
"I beg pardon. Captain Jared Leckie, your servant, ma'am. I'm a surgeon with the 2nd New Jersey."
He eyed me consideringly, clearly wondering who the devil I was. I was wearing a canvas apron with capacious pockets over my gown, these pockets presently stuffed with all manner of small instruments, dressings, bottles and jars of ointments and liquids. I'd also taken off my broad-brimmed hat when I came into the tent and, as usual, was not wearing a cap. I had bound up my hair, but it had come loose and was coiling damply round my ears. He obviously suspected me of being a laundress, come to collect soiled linen, or possibly something worse. "I am Mrs. Fraser," I said, drawing myself up with what I hoped was a gracious nod.
"Mrs. General Fraser, that is," I added, seeing that he appeared unimpressed.
His eyebrows shot up, and he looked me openly up and down, his eyes lingering on the top pockets of my apron, these featuring an unwieldy rolled dressing in the act of coming unrolled, and trailing down my front, and a jar of asafoetida, whose cork was loose, thus allowing the reek of it to waft gently above the other notable smells of the camp. It was known commonly as devil's dung, and for good reason.
I pulled the jar out and pushed the cork in more securely. This gesture seemed somehow to reassure him.
"Oh, the General is a physician, I perceive," he said.
"No," I said, beginning to see that I should have uphill work with Captain Leckie, who appeared young and not over-bright. "My husband is a soldier. I am a physician." He stared at me as though I told him I was a prostitute. Then he made the mistake of assuming that I was joking and laughed heartily. At this point, one of my patients, a young mother whose one-year-old son had an ear infection, poked her neatly capped head hesitantly into the tent. Her little boy was in her arms, howling and red-faced. "Oh, dear," I said. "I'm so sorry to keep you waiting, Mrs. Wilkins. Do bring him in. I'll get the bark for him directly." Captain Leckie frowned at Mrs. Wilkins and beckoned her closer. She looked nervously at me, but allowed him to lean down and look at little Peter. "He has a difficult tooth," Leckie said, rather accusingly, after running a large, unwashed thumb through Peter's drooling mouth. "He ought to have the gum slit to let the tooth come through." He began to fumble in his pocket, where he doubtless had a highly unsanitary scalpel or lancet. "He is teething," I agreed, shaking out a quantity of crumbled willow bark into my mortar. "But he also has an ear infection, and the tooth will come through of its own accord within the next 24 hours. He rounded on me, indignant and astonished.
"Are you contradicting me?"
"Well, yes," I said, rather mildly. "You're wrong. You want to have a good look in his left ear. It's..."
"I, madam, am a diplomate of the Medical College of Philadelphia."
"I congratulate you," I said, beginning to be provoked. "You're still wrong." Having thus rendered him momentarily speechless, I finished grinding the bark into powder and poured it into a square of gauze, which I folded into a neat packet and handed to Mrs. Wilkins, with instructions as to the brewing of the infusion and how to administer it, as well as how to apply an onion poultice. She took the packet as though it might explode, and with a hasty glance at Captain Leckie, fled, little Peter's howls receding like a siren in the distance. I drew a deep breath. "Now," I said, as pleasantly as possible, "if you're in need of simples, Dr. Leckie, I have a good supply. I can..." He had drawn himself up like a crane eyeing a frog, beady-eyed and hostile.
"Your servant, ma'am," he said curtly,
and stalked past me. I rolled my eyes up toward the canvas overhead. There was a small gecko-like creature clinging to the cloth, who viewed me with no particular emotion. "How to win friends and influence people," I remarked to it. "Take note." Then I pushed the tent flap back and beckoned for the next patient to come in. I had to hurry in order to make my rendezvous with Jamie, who was just about to begin his review when I dashed up, twisting my hair into a mass and pinning it hastily under my broad-brimmed hat. It was a terribly hot day. Being in the open sun for only a few minutes had made my nose and cheeks tingle warningly. Jamie bowed gravely to me and began his advance along the line of men drawn up for review, greeting men, saluting officers, asking questions, giving his aide-de-camp notes of things to be done. He had Lieutenant Schnell with him as his aide-de-camp, a nice German boy from Philadelphia, perhaps 19, and a stout gentleman I didn't know, but assumed from his uniform to be the captain in charge of whatever companies we were inspecting. I followed them, smiling at the men as I passed, while looking them over sharpish for any overt signs of illness, injury, or disability. I was sure that Jamie could spot excessive drunkenness without my expert opinion. There were 300 men, he told me, and most of them were quite all right. I kept walking and nodding, but wasn't above beginning to fantasize some dangerous circumstance in which I found Captain Leckie writhing in pain, which I would graciously allay, causing him to grovel and apologize for his objectionable attitude. I was trying to choose between the prospect of a musket ball embedded in his buttock, testicular torsion, and something temporarily but mortifyingly disfiguring, like Bell's palsy, when my eye caught a glimpse of something odd in the lineup. The man in front of me was standing bolt upright,
musket at port arms, eyes fixed straight ahead. This was perfectly correct, but no other man in the line was doing it. Militiamen were more than capable, but they generally saw no point in military punctilio. I glanced at the rigid soldier, passed by, then glanced back.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ!" I exclaimed,
and only sheer chance kept Jamie from hearing me, he being distracted by the sudden arrival of a messenger. I took two hasty steps back, bent, and peered under the brim of the dusty slouch hat. The face beneath was set in fierce lines with a darkly ominous glower, and was completely familiar to me.
"Bloody effing hell," I whispered, seizing him by the sleeve. "What are you doing here?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you," he whispered back, not moving a muscle of face or body.
"Do walk on, my dear."
Such was my astonishment, I might actually have done it, had my attention not been drawn by a small figure skulking about behind the line, trying to avoid notice by crouching behind a wagon wheel.
"Germaine," I said,
and Jamie whirled about, eyes wide. Germaine stiffened for an instant, and then turned to flee, but too late. Lieutenant Schnell, living up to his name, sprang through the line and grabbed Germaine by the arm.
"Is he yours, sir?"
he asked, glancing curiously from Jamie to Germaine and back.
"He is,"
Jamie said, with a tone that had turned many a man's blood to water.
"What the devil?"
"I'm an orderly,"
Germaine said proudly, trying to detach himself from Lieutenant Schnell's grip.
"I'm supposed to be here."
"No, you're not," his grandfather assured him. "And what do you mean, an orderly? Who's orderly?"
Germaine at once glanced in John's direction, then, realizing his mistake, jerked his eyes back, but it was too late. Jamie reached John in a single stride and ripped the hat off his head. The face was identifiable as that of Lord John Grey, but only by someone who knew him well. He wore a black felt patch over one eye, and the other was all but obscured by dirt and bruises. He'd cut his luxuriant blonde hair to roughly an inch in length, and appeared to have rubbed dirt into it. With considerable aplomb, he scratched his head and handed Jamie his musket.
"I surrender to you, sir," he said in a clear voice. "To you, personally. So does my orderly," he added, putting a hand on Germaine's shoulder.
Lieutenant Schnell, quite flabbergasted, let go of Germaine as though he were red hot.
"I surrender, sir,"
Germaine said solemnly, and saluted. I'd never seen Jamie at a complete loss for words, and didn't now, but it was a near thing. He inhaled strongly through his nose, then turned to Lieutenant Schnell.
"Escort the prisoners to Captain McCorkle, Lieutenant."
I said apologetically. A hard blue eye swiveled in my direction, brow raised.
"He's injured,"
I said, as mildly as I could, with a brief gesture in John's direction. Jamie's lips compressed for an instant, but he nodded.
"Take the prisoners and Mrs. Fraser."
I dare say it was merely sensitivity on my part that perceived a certain emphasis on Mrs. Fraser.
"To my tent, Lieutenant."
With scarcely a breath, he turned on John.
"I accept your surrender, Colonel,"
he said with icy politeness.
"And your parole. I will attend you later."
And with that, he turned his back on the three of us in what could only be described as a marked manner. "What on earth happened to your eye?" I demanded, peering at it. I had John on the cot in my small medical tent, the flap open to admit as much light as possible. The eye was swollen half shut and surrounded by a sticky black ring where the felt patch had been peeled away. The underlying flesh, a lurid palette of green, purple, and ghastly yellow. The eye itself was red as a flannel petticoat, and from the irritated state of the eyelids, had been watering more or less constantly for some time.
"Your husband punched me when I told him I'd bedded you," he replied with complete composure. "I do hope he didn't take any similarly violent actions upon being reunited with you."
Had I been capable of a convincing Scottish noise, I might have resorted to one. As it was,
I merely glared at him.
"I decline absolutely to discuss my husband with you," I said. "Lie down, blast you!" He eased himself back on the cot, wincing. "He said he hit you twice," I remarked, watching this. "Where was the second one?"
"In the liver."
He gingerly touched his lower abdomen. I pulled up his shirt and inspected the damage, which amounted to further spectacular bruising around the lower ribs, with blue streaks draining down toward the ileal crest, but little more. "That's not where your liver is," I informed him. "It's on the other side."
"Oh."
He looked blank.
"Really? Are you sure?"
"Yes, I am," I assured him. "I'm a doctor." "Let me look at your eye." I didn't wait for permission, but he didn't resist, lying back and staring up at the canvas roof while I spread the eyelids as far as possible. The sclera and conjunctiva were badly inflamed, and even the dim light made the eye water profusely. I held up two fingers.
"Two,"
he said, before I could ask.
"And before you start ordering me to look to and fro and up and down."
"I can't."
"I can see out of it, though it's a bit blurry, and I see everything doubled, which is very disagreeable, but I can't move it at all. Dr. Hunter opined that some muscle or other was trapped by some sort of bone. He didn't feel competent to deal with it."
"I'm flattered that you think I might be."
"I have the fullest confidence in your abilities, Dr. Fraser," he said politely. "Besides, have I any choice?"
"No. Keep quite still there."
"Germaine!"
I had caught sight of a telltale flutter of pink calico from the corner of my eye, and the runaway came sidling in, looking vaguely guilty.
"Don't tell me what you have in your shirt," I said, noting a suspicious bulge or two. "I don't want to be an accessory to crime."
"No, wait. Is it alive?"
Germaine prodded the bulge as though not quite sure, but it didn't move, and he shook his head.
"No, grandmère."
"Good.
Come here and hold this, will you?" I handed him my pocket looking-glass, and, adjusting the tent flap so that a ray of light shone in, then adjusted Germaine's hand so that the reflected light shone directly from the mirror into the affected eye. John yelped slightly when the light struck his eye, but obediently clutched the sides of the cot and didn't move, though his eye watered terribly. All the better. It would wash out bacteria and perhaps make it easier to move the eyeball. Denny was most likely right, I thought, selecting my smallest cautery iron and slipping it gently under the lower lid. It was the best thing I could find for the job, being flat, smooth, and spade-shaped. I couldn't move the globe of the eyeball upward at all. Even slight pressure made him go white. I could move it slightly from side to side, and, given the sensitivity of John's face just below the eye, I began to form a mental picture of the damage. It was almost certainly what was called a blowout fracture, which had cracked the delicate bone of the orbital floor and forced a displaced bit of it, along with part of the inferior rectus muscle, down into the maxillary sinus. The edge of the muscle was caught in the crack, thus immobilizing the eyeball.
"Bloody, bloody-minded effing Scott," I said, straightening up.
"Not his fault," said John. "I provoked him."
He sounded excessively cheerful, and I turned a cold look on him. "I'm not any more pleased with you," I informed him. "You aren't going to like this, and it will serve you right. How in heaven's name did you—"
"No, don't tell me now. I'm busy."
He folded his hands across his stomach, looking meek. Germaine sniggered, but desisted when I gave him a glare of his own.
Tight-lipped, I filled a syringe. Dr. Fentiman's penis syringe, as it happened.
How appropriate.
With saline solution for irrigation, and found my small pair of needle-nosed forceps. I had another peek at the site with my makeshift spatula, and prepared a tiny curved needle with a wet catgut suture, cut very fine. I might manage without needing to stitch the inferior rectus. It depended whether the edge of the muscle had frayed very badly by reason of its long entrapment, and how it survived being dislodged. But best to have the suture handy in case of need. I hoped the need wouldn't occur. There was so much swelling. But I couldn't wait several days for it to subside. What was troubling me was not so much the immediate reduction of the fracture and freeing of the muscle, but the longer-term possibility of adhesion. The eye should be kept fairly immobile to aid healing, but doing that might cause the muscle to adhere to the orbit, literally freezing the eye permanently. I needed something slippery with which to dress the site, something biologically inert and non-irritating. In my own time, sterile glycerin drops would have been instantly available, but here... Egg white, perhaps? Probably not, I thought. Body heat might coddle it, and then what? John! A shocked voice behind me made me turn, needle in hand. A very dapper-looking gentleman in a stylish wig and a grey-blue velvet suit was standing just inside the tent flap, staring aghast at my patient.
"What's happened to him?"
Percy Beauchon demanded, spotting me in the background. "Nothing serious," I said. "Are you?"
"Leave," said John,
in a voice I'd never heard him use before. He sat up, fixing the newcomer with as steely a look as could be managed with one badly watering crimson eye.
"Now! What in God's name are you doing here?" Beauchon demanded.
His accent was English, but English faintly tinged with French. He took a step nearer and lowered his voice.
"Surely you have not become a rebel?"
"No, I bloody haven't.
Leave," I said. "Dear God, you mean you... What the devil happened to you?"
He'd come close enough now to behold the complete picture. Filthy cropped hair, filthy dishevelled clothes, filthy stockinged feet with holes in toe and heel, and a distorted visage now directing a glare of bloodshot venom at him. "Now look here," I began, turning on Percy with determined firmness, but Germaine stopped me.
"He's the man who was looking for Papa in New Bern last year,"
Germaine said. He'd put down the looking-glass and was watching the evolving scene with interest.
"Grand-père thinks he's a villain."
Percy cast Germaine a startled look, but recovered his composure with remarkable speed.
"Ah,
the proprietor of Distinguished Frogs," he said with a smile. "I recall. Peter and Simon were their names. One yellow and one green."
Germaine bowed respectfully.
"Monsieur has an excellent memory," he said with exquisite politeness. "What do you want with my papa?"
"An excellent question," said John, putting one hand over his injured eye, the better to glare at Monsieur Beauchon.
"Yes, that is a good question," I said mildly. "Do sit down, Mr. Beauchon,
and bloody explain yourself. And you," I added, taking John firmly by both shoulders, "lie down."
"That can wait," John said shortly, resisting my attempts to flatten him.
He swung his legs over the side of the cot.
"What are you doing here, Percy?"
"Oh, you know him, do you?" I said, beginning to be provoked.
"Certainly. He's my brother. Or was."
"What?" Germaine and I exclaimed as one. He looked at me and giggled.
"I thought Hal was your only brother," I said, recovering.
I glanced back and forth between John and Percy. There was no resemblance at all between them, whereas John's resemblance to Hal was as marked as if they'd been stamped from the same mould.
"Step-brother," John said, still more shortly.
He got his feet under him, preparing to rise.
"Come with me, Percy."
"You're not going anywhere," I said, raising my voice slightly.
"How do you propose to stop me?"
John was on his feet, staggering a little as he tried to focus his eyes. Before I could answer, Mr. Beauchon had lunged forward and grabbed his arm to keep him from falling. John jerked violently away from him, nearly falling again as he stumbled backward into the cot. He caught his balance and stood glowering at Beauchon, his fists half clenched. Beauchon's gaze was locked with his, and the air between them was electric.
"Oh,"
I thought, glancing from one to the other, suddenly enlightened.
"Oh."
I must have made some small movement, because Beauchon's gaze flicked suddenly toward my face. He looked startled at whatever he saw there, then, recovering himself, smiled wryly and bowed.
"Madame," he said.
Then, in perfect, accentless English,
"He is really my stepbrother, though we haven't spoken in some time. I am here as the guest of the Marquis de Lafayette, among other things. Do allow me to take his lordship to meet the Marquis. I promise to bring him back in one piece."
He smiled at me, warm-eyed and sure of his charm, which was considerable.
"His lordship is a prisoner of war," said a very dry Scottish voice from behind Beauchamp, "and my responsibility. I regret that he must remain here, sir."
Percy Beauchamp whirled round, gaping at Jamie, who was filling the tent flap in a most implacable fashion.
"I still want to know what he wants with Papa," Germain said, small blonde brows drawn down in a suspicious glower.
"I should like to know that too, monsieur," Jamie said.
He came into the tent, ducking, and nodded toward the stool I'd been using.
"Pray be seated, sir."
Percy Beauchamp glanced from Jamie to Lord John and back again. His face had gone smooth and blank, though the lively dark eyes were full of calculation.
"Alas," he said, the slight French accent back, "I am engaged to Le Marquis and General Washington just now. You will excuse me, I'm sure. Bonjour, mon général."
He marched to the tent flap, head held high, turning at the last moment to smile at John.
"Au revoir, mon frère." "Not if I bloody see you first."
Nobody moved for the space of 9 heartbeats. I counted them, following Percy Beauchamp's dignified exit. Finally, John sat down abruptly on the cot, exhaling audibly. Jamie caught my eye, and with a slight nod, sat down on the stool. Nobody spoke.
"You mustn't hit him again, grand-père,"
Germain said earnestly, breaking the silence.
"He's a very good man, and I'm sure he won't take Granny to bed any more, now that you're home to do it."
Jamie gave Germain a quelling look, but his mouth twitched. From my position behind the cot, I could see the back of John's neck flush a deep pink.
"I'm much obliged to his lordship for his care of your granny," Jamie told Germain. "But if you think making impertinent remarks regarding your elders is going to save your ass, think again."
Germain shifted uneasily, but rolled his eyes at Lord John in a worth a try sort of way.
"I'm obliged to you for your good opinion, sir," John told him, "and I reciprocate the compliment. But I trust you are aware that good intent alone does not absolve one from the consequences of rash conduct."
Jamie was beginning to flush as deeply as John.
"Germain," I said, "do go away. Oh, see if you can find me some honey, would you?"
All three of them looked at me, startled at this apparent non sequitur.
"It's viscous," I said, with a slight shrug. "And antibacterial."
"Of course it is," John said under his breath in a hopeless sort of way.
"What does viscous mean?" Germain asked, interested.
"Germain,"
said his grandfather in a menacing tone, and he hastily disappeared without waiting for enlightenment. Everyone took a deep breath. "Lie down now," I said to John, before anything regrettable might be said. "Have you got a moment, Jamie? I need someone to hold the mirror while I fix his eye." With no more than an instant's hesitation, they both obeyed, not looking at each other. I was nearly ready. When I got Jamie positioned and the ray of light focused on the eye, I once more irrigated the eye and socket gently with saline solution, then rinsed my fingers thoroughly with the same stuff.
"I need you both to hold completely still," I said.
"I'm sorry, John, but there's no other way to do this, and if we're lucky, it will be quick."
"I have heard that one before," Jamie muttered, but desisted when I shot a sideways look at him.
I was afraid to use the forceps for fear of puncturing his eyeball, so I spread the lids of John's affected eye with the fingers of my left hand, wedged the fingers of my right as deeply into the eye socket as I could, and squeezed. He made a shocked, strangled sort of noise, and Jamie gasped, but didn't drop the mirror. There are not many things in the world slipperier than a wet eyeball. I tried to squeeze as lightly as I could, but there was no help for it.
A light pressure merely allowed the eyeball to pop out of my fingers like an oiled grape. I clenched my teeth and tried again, gripping harder. On the fourth try, I managed to get a sufficient grip as to allow me to try to rotate the eyeball in its socket. I didn't quite manage it, but at least got a better idea of how it might go. 5 minutes later, John was trembling like a blancmange, hands clenched tight on the rails of the cot. Jamie was praying under his breath in Gaelic, and all three of us were drenched with sweat. "Once more," I said, drawing breath and wiping sweat from my chin with the back of my hand. I rinsed my fingers again. "If I can't get it this time, we'll have a rest and try again later."
"Oh, God," said John.
He closed both eyes briefly, swallowed hard, and opened them as wide as he could. Both eyes were watering badly and tears washed down his temples. I felt Jamie move slightly next to me. He refocused the mirror, but I saw that he'd also moved nearer to the cot so that his leg pressed against the rail, just next to John's gripping fingers. I wiggled my wet fingers in preparation, said a brief prayer to St. Clair, patron of sore eyes, and thrust my fingers as deeply into the socket as I could manage. By this time, I had a very clear mental image of the fracture, a dark line beneath the torn conjunctiva, and the line of the inferior rectus muscle wedged into it. I twisted, a short, sharp jerk, before my fingers slipped, and felt the muscle pop free. John shuddered the full length of his body and gave a little moan. "Glory be," I said, and laughed from sheer relief. There was a little blood, not much, on my fingers, and I wiped them on my apron. Jamie flinched and looked away.
"Now what?" he said carefully, not looking at John.
"Now what?" "Oh." I considered that one for a moment, then shook my head. "He has to lie down for several hours with the eye covered, a day or two ideally. If Germaine finds me some honey, I'll lubricate the eye socket with a bit of it to prevent adhesion."
"I mean," Jamie said patiently, "does he require to be kept under a doctor's care?"
"Not all the time," I said, surveying John critically. "Someone, me, I mean, needs to check the eye every so often, but there's really nothing else to be done for it. The swelling and bruises will take care of themselves." "Why? What were you planning to do with him?" Jamie made a small gesture of frustration.
"I would hand him over to Washington staff for interrogation," he said, "but..."
"But I surrendered to you personally," John said helpfully.
He glanced at me out of his working eye.
"That means I'm his responsibility."
"I thank you for that," Jamie muttered, giving him an irritable look.
"Well, you aren't going to tell him anything useful either, are you?"
I asked, putting a hand on John's forehead. "Slightly warm, but no gross fever. Such as the nature of the relations between yourself and the recent Mr. Beauchamp?" Jamie gave a brief snort.
"I can find what his relations are with that wee sodomite," he said bluntly.
He gave John a piercing stare.
"You didn't mean to tell me what he's doing here, do you?"
"No,"
John said cheerfully,
"though it almost certainly wouldn't help you if I did."
Jamie nodded, having evidently expected nothing better, and rose with an air of decision.
"Well, then, I've work to do, and so have you, Sassenach. Wait here for Germaine, if you will, and when you've finished with the honey, tell Germaine he's to be in charge of his lordship. He's no to leave his lordship under any circumstances, save you or I tell him he may. And should Monsieur Beauchamp pay another call, Germaine is to be present at any conversation. He speaks French very fluently," he advised John. "And should you think of attempting to subvert my grandson's loyalty..."
"Sir!"
John said, looking shocked at the mere idea.
"Mm-hmm,"
Jamie said darkly, and left. Chapter 62. The Mule Dislikes You. I didn't know quite what to say to John in the wake of recent events. He seemed similarly at a loss, but coped with the social awkwardness by closing his eyes and pretending to be asleep. I couldn't leave him until Germaine got back with the honey, assuming he found any, but I had a fair amount of faith in his abilities.
Well, no point in sitting about with my hands folded.
I took out my mortar and pestle and set to work, grinding gentian roots and garlic for antibiotic ointment. This occupied my hands, but unfortunately not my mind, which was scampering in circles like a hamster on a wheel. I had two main anxieties at the moment, one of which I could do nothing about, that being the escalating sense of oncoming battle. I knew it very well. I couldn't be mistaken. Jamie hadn't told me explicitly, perhaps because he hadn't had written orders yet, but I knew as clearly as if it had been shouted by a town crier. The army would move soon. I stole a glance at John, who lay like a tomb effigy, hands neatly crossed at his waist. All it wanted was a small dog curled up at his feet. Rollo, snoring under the cot, would have to do, I supposed. John, of course, was the other anxiety. I had no idea how he'd come to be where he was, but enough people had seen him surrender that his presence would be common knowledge by nightfall. And once it was...
"I don't suppose you'd consider escaping if I left for a moment?" I asked abruptly.
"No," he said, not opening his eyes. "I gave my parole. Besides, I wouldn't make it outside the camp," he added.
The silence resumed, broken by the brrrm of a large bumblebee which had blundered into the tent, and the more distant shouts and drumbeats of soldiers drilling, and the low thrashing noises of daily camp life. The only good thing, if one chose to regard it that way, and I might as well, was that the rising sense of battle urgency was likely to preclude official curiosity about John. What the devil would Jamie do with him when the army decamped in the morning, I wondered.
"Grand-mère! Grand-mère!"
Germain burst into the tent, and Rollo, who had slept through Percy Beauchamp's visit without stirring a whisker, shot out from under the cot with an explosive woof that nearly overturned the cot and John with it.
"Hush, dog,"
I said, seeing him glaring wildly round, and took a restraining grip on his scruff.
"And what the...
what's the matter, Germain?"
"I saw him, Granny. I saw him. The man who took Clarence. Come quick."
And without waiting for response, he turned and raced out of the tent. John began to sit up, and Rollo tensed under my hand.
"Sit," I said to both of them,
"and bloody stay." The hairs on my forearms were prickling, even as sweat streamed down my neck. I'd left my hat behind, and the sun blazed on my cheeks. I was panting by the time I caught up with Germain, as much from emotion as from heat.
"Where?" "Just there, Granny. The big bugger with the kerchief round his arm. Clarence must have bitten him,"
Germain added with glee. The bugger in question was big, roughly twice my size, with a head like a pumpkin. He was sitting on the ground under the shade of what I thought of as the hospital tree, nursing his kerchief-wrapped arm and glowering at nothing in particular. A small group of people seeking medical treatment, you could tell as much from their hunched and drooping attitudes, was keeping a distance from him, looking warily at him from time to time.
"You'd best keep out of sight," I murmured to Germain,
but hearing no answer, glanced round to discover that he'd already faded artfully from view, canny child that he was. I walked up, smiling, to the little group of waiting people, mostly women with children. I didn't know any of them by name, but they clearly knew who and what I was. They bobbed their heads and murmured greetings, but cut their eyes sideways at the man under the tree.
"Take him first before he does something messy," was the clear message.
Just as clear as the sense of badly contained violence that the man was radiating in all directions. I cleared my throat and walked over to the man, wondering what on earth I was to say to him.
"What have you done with Clarence the Mule?" Or, "How dare you rob my grandson and leave him in the wilderness alone, you bloody bastard?"
I settled for, "Good morning. I'm Mrs. Fraser. What happened to your arm, sir?"
"Bleeding mule bit me to the bone, goddamn his stinking hide,"
the man replied promptly, and glowered at me under eyebrows ridged with scar tissue. So were his knuckles.
"Let me see it, will you?"
Not waiting for permission, I took hold of his wrist. It was hairy and very warm, and unwrapped the kerchief. This was stiff with dried blood, and no wonder. "Clarence," if it was Clarence, actually had bitten him to the bone. Horse and mule bites could be serious, but usually resulted only in deep bruising. Equines had powerful jaws, but their front teeth were designed for tearing grass, and as most bites were through clothing, they didn't often break skin. It could be done, though, and Clarence had done it. A flap of skin and a good chunk of flesh, about 3 inches wide, had been partially detached, and I could see past the thin, fatty layer to the gleam of tendon and the red, membranous covering of the radius. The wound was recent, but had stopped bleeding, save for a little oozing at the edges. I said non-committally, and turned his hand over. Can you close your fingers into a fist? He could, though the ring finger and little finger wouldn't fold in completely. They did move, though. The tendon wasn't severed. I said again, and reached into my bag for the bottle of saline solution and a probe. Saline was a little less painful for disinfection than dilute alcohol or vinegar, and it was somewhat easier to get hold of salt, at least when living in a city. But I kept a tight grip on the enormous wrist as I poured the liquid into the wound. He made a noise like a wounded bear, and the waiting onlookers took several steps back, as a body. "Rather a vicious mule," I observed mildly, as the patient subsided, panting. His face darkened. "Gonna beat the goddamn bastarding fucker to death as soon as I get back," he said, and bared his yellow teeth at me. "Skin him, I will, and sell his meat." "Oh, I wouldn't advise that," I said, keeping a grip on my temper. "You don't want to be using that arm violently. It could bring on gangrene."
"It could?"
He didn't go pale. It wasn't possible, given the temperature. But I definitely got his attention. "Yes," I said pleasantly. "You've seen gangrene, I dare say. The flesh goes green and putrid. Beastly smell. Limb rots. Dead in days. That sort of thing."
"I've seen it,"
he muttered, eyes now fixed on his arm. "Well, well," I said soothingly. "We'll do our best here, won't we?" I would normally have offered a patient in such a case a fortifying draught of whatever liquor was available, and thanks to the Marquis, I had quite a good supply of French brandy. But in the present instance, I wasn't feeling charitable. In fact, my general feeling was that Hippocrates could turn a blind eye for the next few minutes. "Do no harm, forsooth." Still, there wasn't a great deal I could do to him, armed with a 2-inch suture needle and a pair of embroidery scissors. I stitched the wound as slowly as I could, taking care to slosh more saline over it periodically, and glancing covertly round for assistance. Jamie was with Washington and the High Command as they strategized the imminent engagement. I couldn't summon him out to deal with a mule thief. Ian had vanished on his pony, scouting the British rearguard. Rollo was with Lord John. Rachel had gone off with Denny and Dotty in the Quaker's wagon to look for supplies in the nearest village. And good luck to them, I thought. General Green's foragers had spread out like locusts over the face of the earth the moment the army halted, stripping farmsteads and storage barns in their path. The patient was cursing in a rather monotonous and uninspired fashion, but showed no signs of keeling over in a convenient faint. What I was doing to his arm was unlikely to improve his temper. What if he actually did intend to go straight off and beat Clarence to death? If Clarence was loose, I put good odds on the mule to win any such encounter, but he was very likely tied or hobbled. But then, a horrid thought struck me. I knew where Germain was and what he was doing or trying to do. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I muttered, bending my head over the teamster's arm to hide an undoubtedly appalled expression. Germain was an extremely talented pickpocket, but stealing a mule out of the middle of a gang of teamsters. What had Jamie said? He'd be taken up for theft and hanged or flogged within an inch of his life, and I couldn't do a thing to stop it. Teamsters being what they were, they'd likely just break his neck and be done with it, rather than waiting for any sort of military justice. I swallowed hard and glanced quickly over my shoulder to see if I could spot the teamster's encampment. If I could see Germain. I didn't see Germain.
What I saw was Percy Beauchamp regarding me thoughtfully from the shadow of a nearby tent. Our eyes met, and he instantly came toward me, straightening his coat. Well, I was in no position to look a gift horse or mule in the mouth, was I?
Madame Fraser, he said, and bowed. Are you in need of some assistance?
Yes, I bloody did need assistance. I couldn't drag my surgical repairs out much longer. I darted a look at my massive patient, wondering whether he had any French. Apparently, my face was just as transparent as Jamie had always told me it was. Percy smiled at me and said, conversationally, in French,
I don't think this clot of decaying menstrual blood is capable of understanding more English than it takes to hire the sort of pox and imbecile whore who would let him touch her, let alone understand the tongue of angels.
The teamster went on muttering,
shit fire, fucking ass mule, that goddamn hurts!
I relaxed a little and replied in French, yes, I need help, with the utmost urgency. My grandson is trying to steal the mule this oaf stole from him. Can you retrieve him from the teamster's camp before someone notices?
À votre service, madame,
he replied promptly, and, clicking his heels smartly together, bowed and went off. I took as long as I could over the final dressing of the wound, worried that should my foul-mouthed patient find Germaine among the teamsters, Percy's French manners might be unequal to the occasion. And I couldn't really expect Hippocrates to continue turning a blind eye, were I compelled to do something drastic, if the man tried to break Germaine's neck. I heard a familiar loud braying behind me, though, and turned sharply to see Percy, flushed and a trifle dishevelled, leading Clarence toward me. Germaine sat atop the mule, his face set in lines of vindictive triumph as he glared at my patient. I stood up hastily, groping for my knife. The teamster, who had been gingerly prodding the fresh bandage round his arm, looked up, startled, then surged to his feet with a roar.
Shit fire,
he said, and started purposefully toward them, fists clenched. Percy, to his credit, stood his ground, though he paled a little. He handed the reins up to the Germaine, though, and stepped firmly forward.
Monsieur, he began.
I would have liked to know just what he had in mind to say, but didn't find out, as the teamster didn't bother with colloquy, instead driving a ham-like fist into Percy's belly. Percy sat down hard and folded up like a fan.
Bloody hell! Germaine!
For Germaine, nothing daunted by the sudden loss of support, had gathered up Clarence's reins and tried to lash the teamster across the face with them. This might possibly have been effective, had he not telegraphed his intentions quite so clearly. As it was, the teamster ducked and reached out, clearly intending to grab either the reins or Germaine. The crowd around me had realized what was happening by now, and women started screaming. At this point, Clarence decided to become involved, and laying back his ears, curled his lips and snapped at the teamster's face, coming within a toucher of taking off the man's nose.
Shit-ass fucking mule!
Deeply inflamed, the teamster leapt at Clarence and fixed his teeth in the mule's upper lip, clinging like grim death to his neck. Clarence screamed, the women screamed, Germaine screamed. I didn't scream, because I couldn't breathe. I was elbowing my way through the crowd, fumbling for the slit in my skirt so I could reach my knife. Just as I laid my hand on the hilt, though, a hand came down on my shoulder, haunting me in my tracks.
"Pardon me, milady," said Fergus,
and stepping purposefully past me, walked up beside the lunging mass of mule, teamster, and shrieking child, and fired the pistol in his hand. Everything stopped for a split second, and then the shouting and screaming started again, everyone surging toward Clarence and his companions to see what had happened. For a long moment, it wasn't apparent what had happened.